For the week of February 12th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 136, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, it was a bit of a weekend, huh?
Yes, it was. The Grammy Awards, Whitney Houston.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be getting to Whitney Houston in a minute. First, how about a correction from last week? Since last week, we said that the Super Bowl telecast or broadcast did not break any ratings records. And in fact, it did. It was the most watched television show of all time with over 111, so 111 million people tuning in. And 2.1 million people streamed it at some point during the game online.
Well, it's not a correction. It's an update since we gave you the most accurate information we had at the time.
That's true. We were recording very early on Monday morning right after the Super Bowl. So, yeah, it is a bit of an update.
And but, this, of course, is the most watched scheduled broadcast, as opposed to, say, landing on the moon or some other events which might have across broad channels, you know, have reached a wider audience. This is one program on one network.
Yeah, I would imagine the moon landing had billions of people watching.
Well, there wasn't the same, you know, yeah, again, it depends on, you know, how you describe it and access and measure the audience, because obviously there were fewer people around in the world. But yeah, you know, because you're on the hunt, every network in the world was showing at the same time. So yeah.
Well, on today's show, we will most certainly be touching on the sudden death of Whitney Houston, as we kind of alluded to earlier. When we speak with Jeff Boucher, an entertainment journalist with the Los Angeles Times, who not only oversees the paper's Hero Complex blog, which is amazing, by the way, you've got to check it out, but he also covered the Grammys for the LA Times last night. We'll also be speaking with David Wilde, one of the writers for last night's Grammys telecast, who recently co-wrote the bestseller Diary of a Player with Brad Paisley. During Inside Baseball, we'll be talking to Brian Stelter of the New York Times to try and figure out why young people aren't watching television anymore. So that's right, we have three guests for you today. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, before we get to the Whitney Houston and Grammy news, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office worldwide is Journey to the Mysterious Island, the sequel to Journey to the Center of the Earth, a 3D film. It grossed $53 million worldwide and is now at $100 million and counting. Number two around the world is The Vow, the romantic film starring Channing Tatum and Rachel McAdams. That grossed $51 million worldwide in its debut. Number three is Safe House, the Denzel Washington film, which grossed $49 million worldwide. And at number four is a reissue, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace in 3D. This grossed $43 million worldwide and is another example of why studios must be thrilled. They've seen Beauty and the Beast, this, what was the other one? The Lion King. I mean, they're seeing that there's a whole new audience for movies being reissued in the theaters, especially if they're in 3D.
Which, yeah, they don't even have to make new movies. They can just release
exactly.
Old ones. Yeah.
So, right, well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. So, you know, to people who say that people are sick of 3D and they're over it, well, they keep going seeing old movies just because they're in 3D. So that's kind of amazing. And number five is Chronicle, the number one movie at the U.S. box office last week. It grossed $18 million worldwide. It's at $63 million and counting. And number six is the Daniel Radcliffe film, The Woman in Black, which finally opened in the U.K. after opening earlier in the North American box office. It grossed $16 million worldwide and is at $41 million and counting. And number seven is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. That grossed $12 million worldwide. It's at $652 million and counting. Number eight is Underworld Awakening, another $11 million. It's at $130 million worldwide. At number nine is the George Clooney film The Descendants, an Oscar hopeful. It grossed $11 million worldwide and is at $128 million and counting. At number 10, a one-time Oscar hopeful, which has fallen on hard times in every possible way, commercially and critically, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which grossed $8.4 million and is at $211 million and counting. At number 11, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, $7 million. Would I Lie to You, a French comedy, also at $7 million. And Adam Sandler's film Jack and Jill, one of his biggest flops in his career, as far as his big, broad comedies, that also grossed $7 million worldwide.
Well, you know, one movie that you didn't mention during this week's box office? Hugo.
Well, that's out of the, obviously, that's out of the top 10 in North America.
It's number 14.
It grossed $1.8 million. It's at $64 million and counting. So it's still making a tiny little bit of money, but it's basically at the end of its run. And overseas, it just did not gross enough to break into the top 15.
Top six, yeah. I mean,
well, yeah. This is a movie that's basically run its course worldwide. the Oscar, any Oscar wins it get will help it on DVD, I imagine, not in the theater.
Yeah, Graham King, who was one of Hugo's producers, sat down with Patrick Goldstein of the LA Times last week, and he said, look, you know, there's no way around it. It's been painful that the film was originally budgeted for $100 million and that the schedule spiraled out of control and it wound up being somewhere around $156 million, and he estimates it might have even have gone as high as $170 million.
Well, he didn't. Other people
Other people have estimated. And he said to Patrick Goldstein, I've completely changed my way of thinking about making movies. Maybe from hitting my head too hard a couple of times. Now, when I read a script, I think, what does the audience want to see? In the past, I was only thinking about what I wanted to make. But I'm changing my ways. I'm too old, too tired. I don't want to live on the edge anymore. And I don't think, you know, Hugo is living on the edge.
Graham King is only 50 years old, but he sounds like he's 90 in this interview. I don't think it's a very good idea when you spend your whole career doing passion projects to suddenly try and say, okay, I'm going to try and guess what audiences want. If that's not your strength, you shouldn't switch at this stage. And it's pretty clear what went on here. First, he says they didn't have enough prep time. Second, he says they had no idea how difficult it was going to be to have to make a 3D movie.
Well, yeah, he went through three line producers during the course of production.
Right. So he's working with a director who's never made a 3D film before and is not that sort of technical guy who's always into the latest gizmos. Martin Scorsese has never made a movie that's grossed $150 million in North America, so to give him a $150 million budget is not a good idea.
In all fairness to Graham King, they didn't give him $150 million. They gave him $100 million.
That's too much, too.
I know, exactly. I was going to say.
Box office. But you know, you have a budget and you have to stick to it, so that's another problem. Plus, he's not a natural fit for a family film. He's never made a family film, never made a broad appeal film before like that. So, you know, I know he loves silent movies and milieu, but that doesn't mean he's a natural to adapt this book into a movie. So there were a lot of, you know, issues going in here, but I think to try and switch and say, all right, now I'm just going to make audience-pleasing movies, you know, you're going to be a lot worse at that than what you did here. And at least, frankly, it's a movie that most critics, unlike me, thought was really good. So in the end, yeah, they spent too much money on it, but gee, it's, you know, the result was a good movie as far as most people are concerned. So the fact that it didn't work at the box office, that's going to happen.
Well, I know it's. I know we debated this last week whether it was a front runner for the Best Picture Academy Award, but certainly The Artist took another major step toward that goal of being the best picture this year when it won the BAFTA awards. I guess it was Saturday night.
That's right. It won Best Picture and Best Director and Best Actor for Jean Dujardin. About 20% of the Academy voting on the Oscars are British, so there is overlap between this and the BAFTAs. So it is seen as an indicator, especially when you're dealing with non-British related categories. You know, if you've got a British star, they might squeak by in the BAFTAs where they won in the Oscars. But it's a pretty good indicator of how things are going. You know, it looks like a real horse race between Meryl Streep and Viola Davis. I mean, Meryl Streep won the BAFTA for Best Actress, but she was playing Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of England. So that may have given her an edge there. It looks like, at this stage, if I was going to bet, I would say she's going to get disappointed again.
I think you're right.
The Help was really a really well-liked film, and The Iron Lady simply is not a good movie, though that's not really plays into their thing of how they vote, but I don't know, I'm just not feeling it right now.
Well, either way, the Oscars will be paid for because they have sold out all of their advertising spots at $1.7 million for a 30-second spot. They've sold all of them. And in fact, Bob Iger, I love the fact, by the way, that Bob Iger was in the midst of an earnings call, and that's how this news got announced.
Why wouldn't he be part of an earnings call?
He, of course, the CEO of Disney should be part of an earnings call. But the fact that they're talking about 30-second spots on the Academy Awards, which airs on ABC, a Disney property, I thought it was interesting the way that there was no press release about it. It was like, you know, Bob Iger just kind of mentioning it in passing during an earnings call.
Isn't that the point of the earnings call? Present good news?
Well, I suppose.
I mean, yeah.
Well, now, here's a bit of news about the Oscars, which we should probably get off the Oscars and onto the Grammys, but they're not going to be performing either of the two nominated songs. I mean, first of all, they only nominated two songs this year for Best Song, and one from Rio and one from The Muppets, and now they're going to perform neither.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was bizarre that there were only two nominees this year in that category. There were certainly plenty of other reasonable songs that would have been good choices. I understand why they didn't do it, and I always like when they don't try and turn the Oscars into a variety show. Like, we don't need dance pieces, we don't need this and that. But on the other hand, been fun to see Jason Segel out there doing the Muppet song, and the Rio song could have been a fun production number. It would have been a nice, since there were only two of them, they could have both had a nice full production, and it would have been a nice break in the, you know, endless slog that is the Oscars. So I'm not sure it was the right choice.
Well, you know, before we get off of the Oscars and movies and move on to music and the Grammys and Whitney Houston, you know, I did want to make a note that this past weekend, four movies made over $20 million here in North America. You had The Vow at $41 million, Safe House at $39.3 million, Journey to the Mysterious Island, $27.5 million, and Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, at $23 million. It's really only the second time in history that four movies have opened to more than $20 million each in a single weekend.
In North America.
In North America, yes, of course. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
I had no idea that really it's not just February, but overall, overall. In June and July and December.
Yeah, because usually June, July and December, you know, you've got studios saying, whoa, I'm getting out of the way of that big release. So they don't put four movies out that could earn that much in one weekend, in their opening weekend.
Well, I mean, if you look at the four films in North America, The Vow is a romantic drama that appeals obviously to date movies and women. Safe House is an adult thriller. It's both action and appeals to African-American audiences, of course, and to anybody who likes good movies. Journey 2 is a straightforward family film, and Star Wars is a re-release of one of the biggest movies of all time. So you can see it's a good mix of movies. That's kind of amazing, though. I had no idea. Wow.
Well, moving back to the Grammys, Michael, a few minutes ago, you said that you didn't want the Academy Awards being a big variety show. Well, I think the Grammys was, well, maybe not a variety show, but certainly a huge concert. And joining us now to speak about the Grammys and its telecast is Jeff Boucher of the Los Angeles Times. Of course, we've had Jeff on before. He is the editor of the Hero Complex blog, a blog you have to check out over at the LA Times. And he's living the life we all want to live. He was hanging out during rehearsals for the Grammys and wrote about how Bruce Springsteen was jumping around on stage and all the drama that was taking place there. Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Hey, guys. It's good to be here.
So obviously the Grammys were a huge hit. They reached 39 million viewers. It increased 44% over the ratings from a year ago. It's the second highest ratings in Grammy history. 1984 is now the number one Grammys broadcast, and this is number two. There are a lot of reasons for this. Adele had the biggest album in the world, and she was coming back after throat surgery. You know, it's just the coronation, really, for Adele. That's exciting. And, of course, the Grammys has turned itself into a show of just pure performance, where you only see all nine awards handed out live on the air. But I assume the biggest reason has to be, strangely enough, that Whitney Houston died the day before.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think there was a variety of subplots that came together. It was a confluence of things, but, you know, the shocking death of Whitney, you know, maybe 36 hours earlier, was the thing, I think, that pushed people to really tune in. And again, Adele, as you say, you know, I mean, Rolling in the Deep is the biggest, enjoyed the best year of sales of any song since Elton John's tribute to Princess Diana. The album was by far the bestseller of the year. And I think that at radio, she is an incredible success story because of her crossover into multiple genres, R&B and urban radio, in a way that you don't really see very often anymore. So I think it was the story of two different voices last night, and one of them was looking to the future, and one was sort of looking to a very fresh tragedy.
Well, yeah, and I, you know, on Friday, your article in the LA Times calendar section said performances by Bruce Springsteen, the Beach Boys, and Glenn Campbell could create drama. Little did you realize that you kind of left one thing out, of course, tragically so. But was the drama there for you?
Absolutely. And I hope you're not criticizing me for not predicting the death of Whitney Houston.
No, not at all. No.
I am.
I'm being silly. I think there was a lot of drama. I think Springsteen was just great, and it made me realize how much he builds his songs to be performed live. I mean, they really do take on an entirely different texture and resonance live, and I mean, that's no surprise at this juncture in his career. I thought McCartney did an amazing job. I have a story that's going up a little later today or early tomorrow on
this is literally the saddest story I've seen in relation to the Grammys. Tell people what was being Twittered while Paul McCartney was performing.
Oh, you're talking about on Twitter, all the people who don't know who Paul McCartney is?
Yeah, people going, who's this Paul McCartney guy? And they were not joking.
No, they were not joking, which shows you that, you know, anybody in the world that thinks they're world famous just hasn't been around the world. But actually, I have a story going up a little later today or tomorrow on the sort of behind-the-scenes stuff behind that last number by Paul. And, of course, he did, you know, the Golden Slumbers, Carry That Weight, the end medley, the suite from the end of Abbey Road, or the crescendo of Abbey Road. That was a very late choice. He had been intending to play a different song off Band on the Run up until Friday. And they quickly scrambled. It hadn't, obviously, because Friday had nothing to do with Whitney or anything else. It was just a choice by Paul, who decided that he should sing a different song. So, and then he called Springsteen from rehearsals. Ken Ehrlich, the executive producer of the Grammys, called John Landau, the manager of Bruce Springsteen. Landau handed his phone to Bruce, and Ehrlich handed his phone to Paul, and they talked, and he asked Bruce to come play on it late Friday. So it's just sort of an interesting thing. I think with the context of everything that's happened with Whitney, it's hard to compete with that sort of searing drama, but this is a little story I'm kind of proud of because it has some of the behind-the-scenes stuff that I think Beatles fans will enjoy reading.
Well, you also asked in your piece on Friday, how will Glen Campbell, the country singer and country star, hold up during the show? And that's because, of course, it was announced last year that he is suffering from Alzheimer's disease and he's going to release one last album and go on tour one last time. Well, what do you think? I mean, it seemed to go all right up until the end when you know, the song was over and then he asked where he should go, what he was supposed to do.
Yeah, well, you know, I think as anyone who has someone in their family who has had who has Alzheimer's, anyone who's been near it, knows there's good days and there's bad days. And as time progresses, there's more and more bad days. But I think with, you know, Glenn's performance, I think I know it was a source of anxiety, for the Grammy, creative team. At one point they wanted to do a different song. They wanted to do Wichita Lineman. But Glenn couldn't quite do it, to the level that they hoped for. So they switched to his strongest suit, which is the performance of Rhinestone Cowboy, his great sort of signature hit. You know, they call it Anything Can Happen TV, and I think, you know, really, it really was. You know, and I don't think they knew what was going to happen until it happened. And I thought what he did was very endearing. You know, I found myself kind of smiling, watching him, and just feeling good that his that he had this moment, you know, and that we had this moment watching it.
I thought it was a really good moment. And obviously kids who don't know who Paul McCartney is must have no idea who Glen Campbell is. But in 1967 and 68, he released 8 albums in 2 years. He was on a TV variety show. He was the host of his own show. And he won Album of the Year for By the Time I Get to Phoenix, beating out Simon and Garfunkel and the Beatles, among others. So he was really the king of the world for a few years there in the late 60s and has a long string of good albums. His last album, Ghost on the Canvas, is one of my favorite albums of 2011. So hopefully people will check that out. But I thought it was a sweet night. And I think, you know, obviously Rhinestone Cowboy is an easy sing-along song. So I think that really helped him along. You felt the audience was there rooting for him to do a good time with that number. I thought it was very sweet.
You know, somebody I didn't think the audience would be rooting for was Chris Brown, because, of course, he had a little altercation with Rihanna the eve before the Grammys back in 2009. And now he won a Grammy last night and performed just 2 acts after Rihanna.
Before
Rihanna. Thank you. What did you think of that, Jeff?
Yeah, you know, I mean, 2009 at the Grammys, we were talking about the absence of Chris Brown and Rihanna. He beat the hell out of her the night before the Grammys, and they both missed the show. It's interesting to see the way something like that affects or doesn't affect a career. You know, Chris has had a rough run since then. You know, he came into the night with 3 nominations, which certainly shows that his peers are willing to accept him on a level similar to, you know, previous to that incident. But he, you know, he's had some ups and downs since then as well. I mean, that's not the only thing that's happened. You know, on stage, everything makes sense for Chris Brown. When he's playing, when he's dancing, when he's singing, I think everybody goes, oh, okay, this makes sense. It's just that he's had issues when the music stops. So I think there's some people in the industry that I know who will never look at him the same after that incident. And then there's other people who say, look, you know, things happen. He's a young guy. He made a mistake. Let him move on. If, you know, I mean, compare his career calamity to somebody like R. Kelly and look at, you know, sort of his resurrection and revival and in some, in the eyes of some, you know, redemption. It's amazing how forgiving a hit single can make people.
Well, do you think the new Katy Perry song will be a hit single? She sang a brand new song on last night's Grammy telecast, and you asked...
It's not brand new.
Oh, well, I thought it was, according to the co-writer, she said it was they just finished it a month earlier.
It was re-released online in 2010 before she was even married or just married to Russell Brand, and at that time, it was considered a song about her breakup with an ex-boyfriend. She added in some new lyrics, and that might identify it to her referring to Russell Brand, but I think in general, it's just a... to heck with you breakup song that is malleable and can be seen as, you know, applying to any relationship. But it was an earlier version was released in 2010, leaked online, I should say, before she even married Russell. So clearly was not originally written about him. She added in a line about the diamond ring, which could be seen to refer to Russell. But, you know, it's a song. They grow and they change. But people always want to think it's about this or that person. But she started to write it or, you know, finished a version of it well over a year ago.
Well, Jeff, you asked, will Katy Perry wear her heart on her sleeve? I mean, what do you think now, having seen the performance?
You know, going in, there was people in the creative team of the Grammys, the producing team, who said, you know, Katy is going to do something that's going to speak directly to what happened. And as Michael says, you know, she took this material that had a previous life kind of rejiggered it a little bit. Clearly, though, I mean, she brought it to the stage knowing that people would view it in the context of recent events. So, you know, it's just interesting how many different storylines kind of came together on that stage on one night, you know, and I think time will kind of remember that as a pretty remarkable show because of all those, you know, sort of narratives that are kind of playing out side by side and kind of piling on top of one another. But I think it's interesting how, you know, kind of not really mentioned in much of this is, well, you know, Michael mentioned how there's fewer and fewer awards being given out on the air. I think that's interesting. I also think it's interesting now how many times we hear songs on the show performed that are neither nominees nor classics. I mean, and typically in most years, the only songs you would hear performed would be a nominated song or, you know, a sort of a vintage or a classic being revisited in some new context or by the artist that did it. And now, you know, like Springsteen opening the show with that song. Last year, Mumford & Sons, you know, they did a song that ended up getting nominated this year because I think they did it on the show last year. I think that sort of propelled that song forward. And I'm wondering how, as time goes forward, how the Grammys are going to deal with that, because you're going to see more and more pressure from executives saying, well, if I go on the show, if I have my artist go on the show, I want to sing the new single. I want to sing the song that's coming out. And if that's going to take it away from the mission of kind of celebrating the excellence of already released music.
Well, no, yeah, you had Bruce Springsteen sing his new song. The album isn't even out yet. You had Bon Iver, who won Best New Artist, who didn't want to perform because he was asked to perform, I guess, in one of those tribute moments there. And he said, you know, no thanks. I would agree with you. It really is becoming kind of like a little hit maker venue rather than a tribute to those songs that were nominated over the year.
Well, I think it's more of a celebration of music overall. I like the tribute to the Beach Boys, though I thought both Maroon 5 and Foster the People did a terrible job. I like the Glenn Campbell tribute, which I thought went off better. I like Paul McCartney ending the show with a sort of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame jam session where you got to see Dave Grohl from Foo Fighters and Bruce Springsteen and Paul's band all trading guitar licks for a little bit. It's sort of a nice way to end the show with a classic song by a classic artist, you know, cap off the evening with another sort of special performance that you never get to see with all these people getting together. So I like that sort of feel where they're not feeling obliged to simply do whatever, you know, the 14 songs that we've seen performed all year long. You know, you've seen them on Letterman and Leno and this show and that show. So I like the fact that they're not sticking to that script. I think it makes it a richer, better show. But at the heart of it, of course, was Jennifer Hudson and her tribute to Whitney Houston. Jeff, what did you think of that performance? And did you watch her in rehearsal?
You know, I did not watch Jennifer rehearse. She, I think, rehearsed early Saturday. And by that point, I was moving on to some other things. And also, they really locked down the arena for that one, I'm told, because they just weren't sure what they were going to do, and they wanted everybody to be very comfortable. There was different approaches to how they were going to actually execute that sequence. And I think that they wanted to do those things privately, just because of the sort of the delicate nature of the situation, the context.
Well, she had less than 24 hours to prepare. This is Jennifer Hudson, who's singing a tribute to Whitney Houston, less than 24 hours after the pop singer's death was announced. And she started it off a cappella, which...
Just like the original.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable that she was able to pull that off in such a short period of time.
I think, though, if you had stopped Jennifer Hudson on the street last week and said, sing me this song, she could have done it. Because, I think it speaks to the influence of Whitney Houston. And, you know, I think Whitney, in many ways, created a lot of the alphabet that is used to write the success stories of the singers that came after her in that particular sector of pop. I think if you look at a Christina Aguilera, Mariah Carey, certainly a Jennifer Hudson, you know, so many things that Whitney did, both stylistically and also in her career approach, her approach to audience, or her approach to the concerts, it became, a template. And I imagine that Jennifer Hudson sang that song over and over and over in front of a mirror with a hairbrush in her hand, when she was a kid. So, I could be wrong, but, it did come together very quickly. It's interesting what if I'm not mistaken, what got cut from the show to make room for that was, a tribute to Clarence Clemons.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Well, he was included in the in memoriam section, but
yes.
And what they did is they bundled Whitney's with the in memoriam section, and the place where I Will Always Love You was being played was going to be Maceo Parker doing Jungleland.
Oh my! That would have been amazing.
I'd hate to make that phone call.
Oh my!
By the way, your death of Clarence Clemons just got trumped by the death of Whitney Houston. That has to be awkward. The one thing I did like about her performance was it was a simple piano backing. It started out the same way as the record, but it did not go into the full blown triumphant "I Will Always Love You" that Whitney Houston did and made such a worldwide smash. It was more simple and elegant, and a more fitting way to do that song as a tribute to her, rather than the sort of gloriousness that the song becomes by the end, where you're just belting it out for the whole world to hear with a choir behind you. So I thought that was a smart choice for an in memoriam section.
Yeah, and that's Ken Ehrlich's choice, and in consulting with people like Jack Sussman at CBS and Neil Portnow at the Recording Academy, and Walter Miller, the director. They wanted to keep it humble and subdued. I mean, it's a very strong song. Jennifer's a very strong singer, so. With the arrangement, they chose to keep it somewhat austere. And like you say, Michael, I think it was the exact right choice. I think it was good, too, that there wasn't more Whitney. I know that may be indelicate to say, but that there wasn't more stuff about Whitney during the show, because there was, pointing to all the different things that, were coming together, all the different threads that were coming together on that show. Her loss was fresh. The tragedy was fresh. And the grief was fresh, but there were other things that deserved to be in the spotlight as well.
Well, you mentioned that there were other stories going on the night of the Grammys other than Whitney Houston, and one of those stories was Adele winning, I don't even know how many awards, I think it was six awards, including Album of the Year, and that was kind of overshadowed by Whitney Houston. But for you as a journalist, what was it like covering the Grammys and covering what is a huge entertainment story this past weekend, and then in the midst of it be told, oh yeah, by the way, this incredibly other important event happened? At a big paper, does it matter that because you have so many different reporters, or were you pulled from one story and immediately chasing another?
I love you think that we're overstaffed at this point. I was at Grammy rehearsals with my wife and two kids. I took them along because I wanted them to see Paul rehearse. So we all watched Paul McCartney run through Golden Slumbers three or four times, which was just wonderful. So I was writing from rehearsals on my BlackBerry. I did, I think, three kind of blog posts that were kind of chunky. And I have another one that I've written that hasn't run yet on the story behind McCartney stuff, as I mentioned. And then we went to get some food, and just as we were going to go back out, back in and try to watch Rihanna, is when I got word about Whitney. I went in, I talked to Ken Ehrlich for a minute, and then raced to the office. My family took the train home because I had the car, and I was told I had 2 hours to write the obituary, to research, report, and write the obituary. So that's the one that ran on the front page of the paper. There was nobody else in the office. It was just me sitting there and a guy from the library who brought me a stack of papers. It all came down just to me. And a great editor, Claire Nolan, who was did a really good job making sure the piece was in that final form. But it was actually one of the most grueling 2 hours of my life, just trying to deal with that pressure and the amount of material and the sensitivity of it, and knowing you're competing against the world, you know, and you want to do justice to it. You know, you ask what it's like. I mean, it's what we do. I mean, that's what the job is. And there's a lot of people that would kill to have the job I have. So the last thing I'll ever do is complain about it. My main reflection on it is I'm very, very, very happy that everything was accurate.
That's always a plus. Well, it was, according to you, a Grammys for the record books, as far as, you know, a lot of fascinating storylines and some really good performances on air. What was your favorite album of the year, by the way?
Boy, that's a good question. I do love the Adele album, you know, and I think it's going to really stand the test of time. I think it's interesting how the Grammys really embrace young female singer-songwriters who have a sort of sense of music history. You know, I mean, we've seen that really kind of coalesces the voting. You know, if you look at Norah Jones, Alicia Keys, and Lauryn Hill in a way, and Amy Winehouse in a different way. Those are albums that really resonate, and they get all the these sort of bouquets of these bounties of Grammys. And as you say, Adele won 6, which tied Beyonce for the most by a woman in one night. And I think actually her story wasn't overshadowed by Whitney. I really don't think it was. I think it they're just two different stories. They were side by side.
Well, terrific. Well, thanks for taking the time to stop by and tell us what it was like to cover the Grammys. And everybody should check out your work at herocomplex.com at the LA Times. And we look forward to talking to you again, Daniel, in the future.
It was good talking to you guys. I'll talk to you later.
Well, Michael, I guess we should switch gears from journalists covering the Grammy Awards to those who actually worked on the Grammy Awards. David Wilde is an Emmy-nominated television writer, a best-selling author, and a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. So it's hard to believe he even had time to help write the Grammys. Of course, his latest book, which we've mentioned before on the show, is Diary of a Player, which he co-wrote with Brad Paisley. David, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on some fantastic ratings for last night's Grammy show.
Oh, thank you so much. Sadly, I just checked with my agent. I don't get paid by the viewer, so but it's still gratifying, if not actually financially helpful to me. The Grammys are kind of always sort of one of those shows that pushes you to the edge. So much going on, and this year with with Whitney Houston dying, basically Saturday evening, afternoon, when we have the show on Sunday, then I think we're all at kind of a different level of exhaustion. So I think we're gratified that we didn't demean the moment, that we sort of, I feel like we appropriately and honored what people were thinking. And then I also think we just put on a great, you know, Grammy show that Ken and Ken Ehrlich and the team always do. And I have to say, for me personally, this is my first year with a host in many years, and having LL Cool J, it just, I'm very, very proud of him and the job he did.
He did a great job.
I agree. I couldn't love a guy more, and I'm not even a lady, but I love Cool J.
Well, the in memoriam section is always the trickiest one. You always want to pay as much respect as possible to as many people in the industry. Somebody always slips through the cracks, no matter how careful you are in trying to find out and make sure everybody's included. People always feel slighted. They want more for this person or more for that person. It's always hard. People know that you, of course, had a tribute schedule for Clarence Clemens, so you hadn't really quite figured out the best way to pay tribute to him. And then, of course, Whitney Houston died. And, you know, it's never a slight to any one person to be put in this area or that area, you know, a fuller tribute, a lesser tribute. But it's got to be difficult to juggle the emotions. I don't know how you make the phone call to say, well, we've cut this tribute, and now we're going to do that tribute. That's got to be very hard to do.
Well, Ken Ehrlich is the executive producer, and actually, I don't think, honestly, the decisions that were made were, from my perspective, the right ones, and they were made almost, and by necessity, instantly. I mean, within a few minutes, the decisions were made, and that's all I really should say about that. I actually was proud of the way we continued to honor other people throughout the evening, from Edith James, and, you know, to have a few moments like that. I feel like, you know, Ken Ehrlich and I feel like the team kind of achieved that.
Well, now let me ask you, where were you when you heard the news that Whitney Houston had passed away?
We were watching rehearsals. I mean, I guess, you know, the 3 or 4 days for the Grammys, nonstop rehearsals, and generally these performances are, in many cases, rehearsed a little bit off-site, outside of Staples, but then there are those 3 or 4 days when we see everything and run through it a number of times, and Ken, you know, and the team will make fixes, the lighting, or just almost reconceiving certain things. In this case, in the middle of rehearsal, when there's already a million things going on, the word sort of spread like wildfire, and people were, and in fact, I think Maris, the Recording Academy, had the event with Clive Davis, where we heard fairly early, and then it was just sort of, what do we do? And in the case of sort of my part in it, it was a matter of calling Todd or calling LL and saying, okay, I'll tell you the one interesting, you know, the interesting thing is that about 3:30, I think, he called me and said, okay, I love what we have for the open. We're locked and loaded, and I'm going to go study it. And then I called him and said, I guess we're unlocked and unloaded. And in large part, the open that you saw was about 75%, you know, just worked on that night. And so what I told LL after the show, because I thought he was so good, I said, the good news is, for the first time ever, I feel like we have next year's monologue already written. It's never happened in a war show history, but honestly, there was something I was really looking forward to the other one, but it just, you know, live TV, you have to be responsive to what's going on in the world. And that's actually what the first thing he said. That was what I sort of wanted to get across right away was, you know, Bruce speaks to his times. How do we speak to this time? That was something that I emailed LL and Ken Ehrlich at 4:30 in the morning when I woke up. I said, okay, that's the way we can sort of transition and make this work. That was literally, and both of them emailed, I guess everyone was up at 5:30. I got 2 emails back going, this is right, I think, and I love this, or, you know, we were all on the same page as of sort of that moment, that was the way we had to go. And the interesting other part that LL played a huge part in is that, you know, he's generally, well, just anything you deliver, he'll sell, and then we'll work with him to make it his own. But when I sent him the sort of what I thought was the open, he said, I feel like we need to go down further before we go up this high. And he wanted to say a prayer. And I said, I think that maybe is very powerful. I said, I don't generally write prayers. What kind of prayer are you thinking? And he sent me something that was significantly the same as the prayer he offered. So that came from him and from his heart. And there was some discussion about whether it's appropriate or fitting. And I came down on the end that it's the moment that, you know, especially as a writer, I'm not the one up there saying it. And you have to give, you know, you have to let the man who is standing there in front of, which turns out to be almost 40 million people. It normally would be, I guess, 20 something, but you have to let him say something that's in his heart and true to him. And that's what LL did. And I frankly couldn't, you know, I've been through moments like this before, because I was a head writer on things like A Tribute to Heroes at Telethon. And I remember, like, when Tom Hanks opened that up, I said, you know, I could not be more fortunate, or since we're talking about prayers, blessed to have these people to deliver a message. And in this case, Ella couldn't have been any better to me.
Well, you know, as a writer for the Grammys, I always liken it to going back to hearing Branford Marsalis talk about playing a saxophone with Sting on tour. He said, you know, he's a saxophone player at a rock concert, and he gets, you know, maybe 30 or 40 seconds, maybe a minute to shine. And I would imagine that writing the Grammys, you're doing the same thing. You have these very small moments where you have, you know, a minute maybe to write something that's going to be meaningful and impactful. Is that difficult?
Oh, no, no. In fact, that's what I, well, if I'm good at anything in the world, I'm good. That's what I think. I feel like I'm decent at, and I think that's the role. Is I'm the biggest music fan. I started as a music critic, and that's my background. I just am honored to be in the room with Bruce Springsteen and LL Cool J and Adele, all these people, and I want to get out of the way. But the necessities of TV, which I've sort of just, you know, I came to TV only in the last like decade, really. And music on television is about emotion. And ironically, the worst rated shows of all time have been concerts by great bands. I mean, it almost never has, it doesn't draw people. But these Grammys is largely the performances, it's about the performances. But I feel like my job is to add a certain amount of context, emotion, humor, meaning, history in between these songs to sort of have it tell a story. And that's what, you know, and you're telling a story and you're not sure what the story is. So I don't know what the Dells are going to have that night, but you sort of do prepare to sort of tell the story that's unfolding. And in this case, it all, to me, coalesced to one story from LL, you know, from Bruce Springsteen singing, "We Take Care of Our Own," to LL showing that feeling of this connection to Whitney Houston and saying it's a family, to ending with, you know, Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen and Dave Grohl and Joe Walsh up there showing that that's true, that there is a sort of musical family. So you want to try to tell that story, but you're not, you know, my role is a very small one, but I try to make it as meaningful a one as I can.
And there seems to be, at times with the performances, there seems to be a story unfolding, because with Adele, she sang Rolling in the Deep, which won a Grammy yesterday for Record of the Year. Was it Song of the Year or both, I think, actually. And she started off a cappella. And in a way, I thought, well, okay, she's trying to show, hey, I had surgery on my vocal cords and I'm back. And then she sings this song, does a great job. And the camera stayed on her for a bit. And was that purposeful, like to give her that moment with everybody?
Oh, well, I'm, you know, Lou Horowitz, who does a beautiful, beautiful job doing it. He's a storyteller visually, and he knows how to do it. I would love to know, to be able to claim I know anything about it. But yeah, I think that's what the intention was, to, she is the story. It's not a choreography number. It's a voice. And that's, again, where it all sort of comes together in a way that we've never even discussed. I don't think I ever discussed that performance with Lou, but tried to write something for Gwyneth Paltrow that spoke to that voice and the way we experienced it. So it's all storytelling in different ways. And the musicians are the greatest storytellers, but someone like Lou directing and Ken producing, their storytellers, I'm probably not much of one, but I do try my best.
Of course, you, one of the more delicate moments was having Chris Brown and Rihanna both performing within a few minutes of each other. I assume you kept two acts between them so they wouldn't necessarily bump into each other backstage. I mean, that's got to be a very difficult.
That Ken Erlich does a rundown and we discuss it, you know, the scene. But that's I don't know. I mean, I know there's some controversy. Some people are unhappy with it. I mean, my only sense, and I was not involved in this discussion, but I'm fairly confident saying that if Rihanna didn't want him on the show, he wouldn't have been on the show. That is my hunch. That's not my, I was not involved in those discussions, but I think there's sort of a, within the music, and I, you know, within the music community, even a sense of, you know, by putting someone on the Grammy stage, we're not endorsing everything they've ever done, but we are, you know, if someone has done their time in the view of the law, and even in the view of their victim, I think there are such things. There is such a notion as redemption.
Right. Well, you know, it seems, you know, we've talked a lot about the performances last night, and really the Grammys has become a show of performances, but it's also really become a show where a musical act or a band can really break out, much like Mumford & Sons did last year during the Grammys, during a great set piece with Bob Dylan and the Abbott Brothers. This year, you had Civil Wars, who I absolutely love, and I know reading your Twitter account, David, you're a big fan as well, and I was so happy to see that they got a chance to play because they are so good. But Bruno Mars, I thought, just you know, lit the place on fire. I've seen him before, but never like that. And I wonder if the Grammys is going to become one of kind of like a showcase in a way.
Well, let me tell you, that is how it is viewed by these artists. They, you know, I mean, and literally everyone from Bruno Mars to Bruce Springsteen, basically using it to debut, you know, his record. It is. It's the biggest global showcase for music. I mean, it's not just music's biggest night is not a convenient phrase. It's actually literally true. It's the biggest thing in the world. I mean, the numbers, I don't know. I'm trying to think if I've ever written anything that was seen by 30. I don't even know what they're saying. Is it, you know, the
38 million.
Remarkable. And I would guess that these will be the highest rated globally because Adele, it's like sometimes the success is really an American-based success story or rock band, but with the story of Adele, I think I've got to assume that the international interest was tremendous. And in my, and again, I'm not like a ratings scholar, but in my, I think I've done the Grammys for 11, 10 years, the biggest ratings are always when someone has a big night. I guess we like to see if someone's going to run the table. And so I remember Norah Jones having a very, very successful show as well. So I think what happened in this case was there was that aspect of Adele's comeback. And then on top of this, you put the fact that this beloved icon died the day before. And I got to assume people were tuning in to see what the hell are they going to do?
Right.
And yet, I mean, honestly, it's like, I'm sure some people, at least some colleagues in the business, were tuning to see how badly we could screw it up. And that's what keeps you up at night. But I think, you know, I'll give Ken Ehrlich real credit for the main decision was to have Jennifer Hudson sing was right, in my opinion. And I felt, I'll give you this, I don't want to speak for him, but he did immediately convey it had to be an intimate version. It couldn't be a Whitney Houston imitation because no one is Whitney Houston, even Jennifer Hudson. And so it had this other tone and it was spare and elegant and I thought it was perfect. And then I tried to take that same sort of direction for the writing. You know, there were some jokes that were no longer appropriate that were cut. I mean, I have to say it's almost a matter of a sort of survival instinct as a writer to try to get LL to literally say, we're going to laugh and cry and dance and sing, because especially if you begin with a prayer, you've got to get people to understand that we're moving past that portion of the show and having a Grammys. Because, and that was, you know, with no disrespect to Whitney Houston, that's why I put the line in that this show is bigger than any one of us.
It's kind of like a hurt them, then heal them kind of philosophy.
Well, I'll tell you, that's literally what LL said to me. And he said it, he couldn't have been more respectful ever. He said, I'll do exactly this. He says, but I don't think we've gone low enough to rise again. And he was right. And it took a couple of us to, you know, it took us some time. So it took us overnight to realize that. But he was willing to do it without the prayer. But that was his idea. And I will always support the idea of the guy who's actually doing it.
Well, and of course, one of the best things of the show is that it's moved beyond just focusing on the albums nominated that year to sort of take in music history. I felt like the final jam with Paul McCartney was sort of a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame moment where you had a bunch of artists like Springsteen and Dave Grohl jamming with Paul. And in the middle, you had tributes, of course, to Etta James and to the Beach Boys. And then my favorite was the Glen Campbell tribute, which, of course, was also tricky because, you know, we know he's suffering from Alzheimer's. We want to make sure he's having a good day. Some days he is, some days he isn't. I'm not sure when the decision was made or how you guys worked it out so that if it wasn't a good day for him, maybe it would have just been a tribute to him if he didn't feel up to performing, or who would make that call, how that worked out. I know they switched the song from Wichita Lineman to the perhaps easier sing-along Rhinestone Cowboy. That made a lot of sense. So I thought it came off
actually,
really well.
I don't think that's actually true, just because I will tell you, I write the CMAs, which are the country show, and we honored, I think it's partly informed by the fact that we honored Glenn on the CMAs. He did not perform. And in that case, we went for the Jimmy, you know, the sort of
the Jimmy Webb.
Big Jimmy Webb classic. And there was the thought very early on, I believe, to try to go a different way. And, I thought the Glenn Campbell segment was beautiful. And he's like one of the first. And my parents had Glenn Campbell records that I sort of raised on them, so I was happy to see how well that worked out.
Well, there are tributes to older artists like Glenn Campbell and Etta James, but then, and as somebody who not only writes the Grammys, but writes about the Grammys, I believe you have a book about the Grammys, what does the inclusion of dance music with both David Guetta and Deadmau5 performing last night? It was the first time that dance music was included in the Grammys. Does that kind of make it, it's kind of been invited to the party, so to speak. Where does dance music go from there?
I don't know, but there was, you know, again, there's a Recording Academy, the show, you know, there is a very strong input by the Recording Academy, and there was a feeling, and definitely, I believe, Jason Bentley, who you might know as a personality, Jason is on the TV committee for the Grammy, someone who I just met recently from this year's show, and there were people advocating to do something, and then Ken Ehrlich had to figure out a way in the context of the Grammys to do it. And I was just with them. We were just having our sort of after show meeting with downtown, which is why it's a little loud. And what he said was, it was always this, he goes, I would love to have done this a couple of years ago, but it's this issue of you can't do dance on a proscenium, in a theater. You can't get the whole club experience. It's three dimensional. So you have to create a space. So that was the idea of the tent. And I have to say, I haven't, I think it was very gutsy and interesting. I haven't even been home long enough to watch the whole show. But before you go dance music, think about rap on the Grammys. And, you know, it's not like the Grammys were right out of the box on top of everything. But you cut to a couple years later, even the symbolism of LL Cool J, who was one of the sort of founding creative forces, that he's up there hosting. It's sort of, it takes time for, you know, I think any institution to grapple with the changes that are always happening.
Well, it was a fantastic show, so congratulations. And certainly congratulations on the success of your book. I mean, it's certainly been out there and doing quite well. Diary of a Player, which you co-wrote with Brad Paisley.
I got to say, he's my host on the CMAs with Carrie Underwood, and I feel very lucky to have, to work with musicians and artists you love as hosts is great. It's better than writing for, a game show host.
Well, thank you. I know you just finished writing the Grammys, and it was a long, well, not only night, but long week. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, no, my pleasure. And thank you. I'm going to call 38 million people and thank them later today for watching.
I would start with the A's and work your way.
I'm starting at the A's and I'll be working through it. But thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Brad Paisley's album, This Is Country Music, is on my list of one of the best albums of the year. So I'll have to read that book.
Yeah, it's well worth reading. Were there any other albums that were on your end of the year list?
Well, listen to the show notes. I posted my list of the best albums of 2011. I did on Huffington Post. I do it the Friday before the Grammys. That's when I finally catch up on everything. I've got about 55 or 60 albums listed there, you know, from pop, rock, soul, country, blues, jazz, gospel, you name it. And my favorite album of the year is Fleet Foxes' Helplessness Blues. But there was a lot of really good music. The top four or five albums of the year for me were all sort of neck and neck, including Tom Waits and Gillian Welch and a band most people have probably not heard of called King Creosote, who collaborated with John Hopkins on this beautiful little concept album called Diamond Mine. But, you know, they can check it out in the show notes and get a link to all the albums I love this year.
Yeah, including Tom Waits' Bad As Me, which came in at number two for you.
It could have been number one. It was a terrific album. I think it's one of the best albums of his career. He's been very dissonant in the last decade or so, very clangy and dissonant, and I love it. I love a lot of his albums that he's done in the last decade or so. But this is more of a turn to the 70s bohemian, and the sort of his singing is a little more restrained. It's not quite as industrial, the sound on this album, though there's certainly some very fun, rough stuff. So I think it's one that longtime fans who haven't been down with some of the more hard-edged stuff that he's done the last few years, they might really like to check out.
Well, I think anytime Tom Waits releases an album, it's a big deal.
Absolutely. It's a big deal, and it would be a big whoop if you didn't pay attention to it.
Oh, yes. Well, that moves us right along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story? Oh, you're going to love this one. Movie ticket prices hit an all-time high. The average movie ticket price in North America was $7.93 in 2011, a new all-time high. Movie ticket prices have risen every year since 1992 and faster than inflation. Studios blame tentpole pictures, theater owners, their lavish new digital and 3D-ready digs. Consumers just check what's on Netflix, as ticket sales were the lowest since the mid-1990s. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I wish we'd had this information when we spoke to our friend from NATO. Movie ticket prices have risen faster than inflation for 20 years now, so it's not a surprise when people say that they're complaining movie ticket prices are going up too fast. And you know what? People don't act as economists. Yeah, if you adjust for inflation, movie tickets are still a pretty good purchase, but that's not how people think about it. When you ask them to pay $15 or $18 for a ticket to a movie, and then they know they can buy a movie 3 months later for $20, they don't feel like it's worth it. So I think they're really pricing themselves out of the business to a degree. I think it's scary. I've often emphasized long-term how ticket sales are very strong and people do go to the box office a lot. But there's a point where you're going to reach a breaking point, and I think they're getting closer and closer to it all the time.
Well, it's basic economics. Supply, demand, price. And as price increases, demand decreases. It's, you know, economics 101. Literally, that's what I learned in economics 101 in college.
And we talk a lot about showcasing, and I think the importance of having movies displayed in theaters and all that advertising and attention that they get, of course, makes them valuable all every step down the line, from video on demand to DVD to streaming to everything. And I think it's really, really important that they make movie going and the theatrical experience as common and everyday occurrence as possible, and not a big 2 or 3 time a year event.
Yeah, and you know, John Fithian from the National Association of Theater Owners, from NATO, always says, you know, since 1968, inflation has outpaced the rise in the price of movie tickets. But that's because he's going all the way back to 1968, and he's not picking it up in the 1990s.
True enough.
Our next story, Redbox and Verizon are teaming up. Amazon and Netflix have some new competition. Redbox, the company behind those red DVD kiosks that you see everywhere, is teaming up with Verizon, the cell phone provider, to offer video on demand online. The service will be available to everyone, not just Verizon customers, and will launch in the fall. No word yet on deals or what titles or how many it will offer. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop until we get some more information. I'm not quite sure what Redbox brings to the table other than their brand name, but you know, we'll have to see when we get more, you know, facts.
Well, I can tell you why Redbox wants to get involved in this, because they want some way into the home. And Verizon, besides selling cell phones, of course, they offer, they're an ISP. They offer cable and internet access to consumers at home. And this is their way of getting away from DVDs and into streaming.
Right, but Redbox doesn't have any deals for streaming movies.
And there's the rub.
I'm not sure what they bring to the table. They buy, half the time, they have to just buy DVDs from a warehouse distributor because the studios won't sell them directly. So other than their name, what do they bring to this? I'm not quite sure.
Well, I think a lot of people were asking that question. Now, speaking of studios not selling to Redbox, Disney helped create the home video sell-through market by selling its classic animated films on VHS originally. Now it wants to put the brakes on rental again by adding a window. New Disney titles will be available for sale on DVD and Blu-ray a full month before Disney will sell them directly to Redbox or Blockbuster and other entities like Netflix. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. These windows are, you know, everybody's trying to figure out what makes sense, what works for them. They claim that if they make them available for rental at $1 a day, that it undercuts sell-through. I'm not sure. I think they're different markets. So I think you should make them available in every possible way at that stage. You know, when you're talking about video on demand and DVD and sell-through, I think, you know what, if you're going to rent it for $2 or $3, that doesn't mean, you know, you've lost a sale. I just don't see the connection.
Well, really, it's in this news kind of, again, came out during Bob Iger's earnings call for Disney, the CEO of Disney. Income was up 12%. But when you look at where that came from, it was from theme parks and from other channels. It was not from the film channel, where they say the studio's revenue fell 16% to $1.6 billion for the last quarter of 2011.
And they blame Redbox.
Well, they blame DVD sales in general.
Well, DVD sales reached a career peak, which was sort of natural. People bought new libraries, they transferred over. That was never going to maintain. So, you know, to complain that DVD doesn't set new record sales heights every year is to me, foolish.
And now they'll get them to buy it all over again on Blu-ray.
But they won't. No, they won't.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's why it's not working.
Well, now there's some news about Amazon streaming service.
This is getting confusing. It's all streaming and deals and DVDs.
This may as well be inside baseball, but But Amazon signed a deal with Viacom, which owns Paramount, of course, as well as a number of television networks, last Wednesday. And the deal will bring the number of titles available as part of Amazon's Prime Instant Video service to more than 15,000, which is three times the amount of content the service launched with initially. Some of the content available will be all the Comedy Central shows, like
so you can take your Kindle Fire and watch The Daily Show.
Correct, or iCarly, or Dora the Explorer from Nickelodeon, or Love and Hip Hop from VH1, or Hot in Cleveland from TV Land, or Jersey Shore from MTV. So that's really what they're doing. Now, at the same time, you have Amazon and Amazon Studios. They're looking for creative executives to begin producing their own programming. So is all of this, you know, the deal with Viacom and Amazon Studios producing their own programming, a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal as far as it's another step in the process of making, you know, Amazon Prime and their Kindle Fire a strong competitor to, you know, other sources of programming. I assume this is not an exclusive deal.
Probably not, no.
Right, so that's fine. I think Paramount should make their stuff available on the Kindle Fire and Hulu and Netflix and whoever else is out there that offers fair enough terms so that they can be available on as many platforms and let the audience decide where they want to go. You know, this is not a dramatic deal that sort of suddenly makes Amazon Prime amazing. It's, you know, 15,000 titles is nothing. I think Netflix ships out like 30,000 different titles every week. You know, they send out millions of DVDs covering 30,000 different titles every week. So, you know, 15,000 overall is not exactly overwhelming yet, but they'll keep adding people, and they should.
Most movies and theaters and artists try to discourage people from tweeting, emailing, talking, and photographing during performances. But for one night only, Broadway's Godspell is actually encouraging it. They're setting aside seats that won't disturb other patrons and encouraging the people who sit there to tweet throughout the performance. It's taking place Sunday, February 19th at the evening performance. No word yet on whether other theatergoers can videotape them tweeting and post it on YouTube. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop, and it's like the worst idea I've heard in ages. It's such a bad idea. Like, what are they? I guess they must be seats in the back row. Otherwise, how could they not disturb other people? But it's just moronic. Like, oh, we have a lot of fans who tweet about our show. It's like, so what? Having them tweet during the show is not a good idea.
I would tend to agree with you.
If you can't remember by the end of the show, you know, I really like this moment when, it's not worth mentioning. And it's just, it's a terrible idea. It goes against everything they should be encouraging. The live theatrical experience is not enjoyed when you're sitting on your phone typing stuff in. So yeah, it's just bad, bad idea. They're being way too clever here.
You can never be too rich or too thin, but apparently you can be too outspoken. Famed dance company La Scala has fired soloist, oh no.
Maria Francesca
Garitano, after she gave an interview saying that anorexia and therefore infertility were rampant among the troupe's female dancers. La Scala said she was fired for quote-unquote damaging the image of the company, which is like blaming the little black girl trying to go to school for damaging the image of the South. Big deal or big whoop? Wow, that was a big one, Michael. That was a big analogy.
Well, I think it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Are we just discovering that eating disorders are rampant in the world of ballet? That should not be a surprise to anyone. It wasn't just one interview. She had published a book.
Oh, okay.
I think in 2010 and had repeatedly given interviews, but she is a major star. She is a prima ballerina. She was one of their top, you know, performers. So she really did put herself on the line. So give credit to her for that. It's obviously a serious issue that's always been present in the arts and especially in ballet. And hopefully, instead of denying that there's a problem, they can actually come together and someday work on it and try to have healthier decisions for their ballet dancers. And hopefully she'll be able to sue them for wrongful firing.
Well, that brings us to Simpsons toys being banned in Iran. Bart Simpson is not welcome in Tehran. Since the animated TV show The Simpsons is not welcome programming in Iran, it shouldn't come as any shock that the country that banned Barbie dolls would also ban dolls of the irreverent Simpsons family. As an official said when defending the ban, even Europe and the U.S. censor some episodes of the show. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. Give me a list of things that aren't banned in Iran, and that I will find interesting.
Many artists have a website. Lady Gaga has launched a website just for her fans called littlemonsters.com. It provides a forum for her fans to meet and talk and share all of their interests, creating a community of little monsters. Perhaps the way the Grateful Dead fans formed their social circles offline back in the 1970s. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things. I doubt that there are many artists that would follow this path. I don't think there are enough people that obsessed with an artist to want to share their lives with other people. But it's interesting. You know, it's an interesting extension of her, you know, her world and giving a new place for her fans to talk. I bet they were probably really, really active on the comments section on her official website. And she decided to give them a bigger forum to share all their interests. And it's interesting.
You know, interesting is what I would call her outfit at the Grammys, Lady Gaga.
She looked like she was trapped behind.
I know. She was wearing this like veil and this whole like, you know.
She knew she was never going to have to speak. So she just decided to have encaged herself in this sort of crazy costume. My friend I was watching the show with leaped back every time they saw her. He's like, who is that? My God, what's going on with that? Oh, he was scared by her outfit. So,
and she had like this big like lance that she was carrying.
Yeah, a little orcane. And she left while Paul McCartney was performing Golden Slumbers. That's tacky. It's like, come on, it's a Beatle. For heaven's sake, you can sit there and listen.
She probably didn't know who he was.
Oh, don't say that.
American Idol's Kelly Clarkson had a banner few weeks. She performed the national anthem at the Super Bowl. She duetted with Jason Aldean at the Grammys. Her newest single was featured in a car commercial, and that song became her third number one single on Billboard's Hot 100, pushing Adele down to number two. Clearly, American Idol can at least boast its winners aren't just flashes in the pan. So is Clarkson's triumph a big deal or a big whoop? And when are we going to stop referring to her as an American Idol?
Never. We will never stop referring to her as an American Idol because she was the first one.
That's true.
She is. It's a big deal. It's a, you know, it's showing a really a serious longevity to her career. She's had ups and downs, but she's clearly a career artist. She's not going anywhere. And it shows the power, I think, of being on television, all those platforms. And if you look at that, you can see Lana Del Rey, her album debuted at number two on the album charts, despite all the bad press she got from her Saturday Night Live appearance. And Madonna got a big boost from the Super Bowl as well. Her single, Give Me All Your Love, and debuted at number 13, which is a, you know, a very strong debut on the charts. And it gives her the second most singles on the Hot 100 by a woman in history, tied with Dionne Warwick, and they're just behind Aretha Franklin. So, hey, there's no radio anymore, so if you want to sell singles and albums, get on television.
The mid-season return of The Walking Dead set more basic cable records. Sunday night's episode reached 8.1 million viewers, a record for the show in total viewers, as well as records in key demos. These are record numbers for a basic cable drama set only months ago by the season 2 premiere of The Walking Dead, which blasted a decade-old standard for what is possible on cable. More viewers will surely be added once DVR figures are factored in. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. The show continues to grow. I think we said this would happen like it did for The Sopranos in season 2 and 3 and 4. You know, these shows reach a big audience and then they can grow and grow and grow if they're really long-term phenomenons. And that's exactly what's happening here. This may not be the end of it because Sopranos reached its peak in season 4. So The Walking Dead could still have a lot of room to grow. And of course, with success comes lawsuits. A former collaborator of the comic book creator Robert Kirkman is now suing him, saying he was tricked into signing away his rights to the piece of the franchise when they were trying to set up a TV deal. So we'll have to see how that all pans out.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you know, what's remarkable to me is that you had 40 million people watching the Grammys and an additional 8 million people at the same time watching The Walking Dead.
Well, not me. I DVR'd it.
Oh, okay. That's true.
So, you know,
you're absolutely
right.
Some of it's
caught in, you know, in the same hour. But I'm sure the Grammys skewed a little bit older, and The Walking Dead had really strong demos in the young. I like it. I think it's a fun show.
Well, Michael, that now brings us to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. Joining us this week is Brian Stelter of the New York Times, and you really have to follow him on Twitter, too. He's an amazing I don't know, tweeter, if that's
a Twitterer.
Twitterer, yeah. He's a media reporter for the New York Times, and he's going to join us to talk about his article this past week called Youths Are Watching, But Less Often on TV. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, we all assumed that people that were between the ages of, say, 12 and 25 were off playing video games or off browsing the internet. But this is kind of the first time that it's actually been proven. Nielsen released this report last Thursday that said, yes, younger people are watching less.
That's right. It's the first time we've seen it in the data. that we can now see it happening. And there have been times in the past where we've seen little blips, but this has happened for at least three quarters in a row now. And it appears to be continuing on into this year as well.
Now, is it that they're doing other things, or are they watching TV in different ways, watching TV via their phone or their iPad or their laptop and watching it via YouTube and Hulu and Netflix rather than sitting down and watching their big screen and DVRing?
There's lots of reason to believe that they are still watching as many shows as they always have, but watching them in different ways, watching them in ways that are not always rated by Nielsen or measured by Nielsen in the same way. You know, there's a couple different segments of the population we're talking about here. We're talking about 12 to 17-year-olds who are watching on average about 9 minutes less TV a day than they used to. And then there's 18 to 24-year-olds, and then there's 25 to 34-year-olds. And I suspect within each segment, the behavior is different. I'm 26, and I know that I watch a lot of my television on Hulu, which is important and which is financially significant for the network. It's not as if they're losing money by having me watch on Hulu, but it's not counted by Nielsen in the same way that television is. So there is a lot of evidence, both anecdotally as well as in other studies, but that's a lot of what's happening here.
Well, now, why is it financially viable for the networks to have you watching on Hulu?
Right. I say that because the networks have ownership in Hulu. They have ads that run on Hulu. And in some cases, there are deals. For instance, Viacom has a deal. They make a lot of money from Hulu to provide content. But yeah, we should add the caveat that I'm not as valuable online as I am on TV in many cases. If you ask a television executive, how do you make the most money off of me? Oftentimes, the answer is if you watch on traditional television.
Live.
So it continues to be a challenge. Live, that's right. So that continues to be a challenge for the whole industry.
Well, there's a couple ways the industry can react. One is to panic and say, all right, we're going to pull our stuff from Hulu and Netflix and try and Roku and try not to make stuff available as quickly. Or they can say, all right, the advertising on Hulu and Roku and other areas should be more valuable, more expensive, and we should be making more money off of it. We should just accept the fact that viewers are watching television this way. What do you think they're going to do? How are they reacting to this information?
Right now, Hulu and Netflix and all of these other ways to watch are supplementary, and the vast majority of viewing happens on television. So I don't see anyone panicking. But listen, these established companies are obviously protectionists. Their job is to protect their core product. And we've seen instances of them pulling back when they think their core product is being threatened. I think it's interesting that this season on Hulu, Fox is holding back some shows for a week, unless you prove you're a cable subscriber, because that cable subscription is more important for them financially than Hulu is. We'll continue to see behavior like that, but I think we're going to have to look for companies like Nielsen to be able to better measure our behavior. If we are watching in different ways, Nielsen's going to have to capture that in different ways.
Do you think that there will be a point where when we hear, oh, 5 million people watched this, we won't have to say, well, 5 million people watched it on TV and 2 million people watched it online, or will it just all be one big pool?
I think we're a ways away from that. I hope we get there someday. It was frustrating to me last week writing about the Super Bowl because, of course, 113 million people watched on average at any given minute during the game on television. Well, we don't know how many people watched on average on any given minute on the internet. We know that 2.1 million people did it at some point. They tried it out online, but the numbers are apples and oranges. Frankly, they're apples and steak. I mean, the differences are so dramatic in the ways that they measure these things. It's going to take a while to fix that, but it would be nice to get to the day where we can say, for the Grammys, 40 million people watched on TV, 20 million watched at bars and workplaces and at the airport, and 20 million watched online. We'll probably get there. It's going to take a while, though.
Well, Nielsen has always historically had a problem counting audiences. Networks have said, hey, you're missing college students in dorms, you're missing people in bars, you're missing people watching as a group. And
yeah,
that's obviously a very tricky thing.
It's always driven me crazy we don't have out-of-home ratings. Arbitron came out with a study that said that, a lot more people watched the Super Bowl than we realized. 20% more watched out-of-home, but they weren't counted by Nielsen. So the reality is that the Nielsen numbers we see are all rough and they are incomplete, and yet they're taken as gospel for the most part.
Well, and this really all matters because of advertising and ad buying. Is that correct?
That's right. We're talking about the currency for the industry here. And when we have incomplete numbers, or we have numbers that everyone knows are lower than they should be, that can affect advertising rates.
I love the story you tell. And, you know, we just talked about the Grammys for a second. And Michael, you mentioned earlier that people were tweeting as Paul McCartney was on the stage. Who is this guy? He's really old. And you have a story here from a guy who's a system administrator in York, Pennsylvania. His name is Jay. Is it Rochelle?
That's right. Yeah.
And his son, Corey, is 4. And his son has become accustomed to watching television via Roku, a small box that streams shows through the internet. And on Tuesday night, Corey asked his dad if he had watched television via Roku growing up. When his dad said no, Corey then said, "So you only watch DVDs?"
And the father decided not to explain that when he was growing up, there were only a few channels because he doesn't think his son knows what channels are. This is a classic case of behavior moving faster than the way that we measure and even talk about it. If you think about it, we don't even have the right terminology to describe this sort of behavior because they are kids that are 4 and 5 years old who are watching on their iPads. They are watching television, but not the television that we know and we describe.
The network should be excited by this because it shows how powerful and valuable their product is. They create an entertaining show, and if you have The Daily Show, people want to watch clips of it online. They want to watch it on their phone. They want to watch it on their iPad. They tape it and watch it on their DVR. So this should be a positive thing for them in a sense that they can see all these new multiple platforms and see that their programming is very, very valuable, and they're going to keep reaching audiences.
I think that's right. I would say that one of the risks, however, is that television itself is the best marketing tool for television. So to get people to sample a new show, you promote the new show during the current show. And if fewer people are watching traditional television blocks with all those traditional marketing commercial spots, that could have an effect over time, over the long term in television viewing, in show viewing. Again, the language doesn't quite keep up here, does it?
No, you're right. I mean, when you see the major record store chains disappear, people were buying music online, but suddenly there's no store to go walk in and see new albums come out. You don't see those billboards on the street. You don't talk to employees who are excited about music. And I think that's one reason beyond piracy why music purchasing has dropped down. We may see the same thing with books. And if people don't have that centerpiece of the TV network where they can all gather together and see things like New Girl or Raising Hope or whatever their new show is that they're excited about, they're not going to be in that stream. They're going to start to fall out of the habit of discovering new shows.
On the other hand, I do like what a site like Hulu does sometimes. Hulu will watch, it'll sense what you're watching, of course. It knows you're watching, say, Parks and Recreation, The Community, or The Office. And then in its commercial break, it'll recommend a show like Parks and Recreation or The Office. It'll look through its catalog and say, oh, well, we have this British import that's a lot like The Office that you might like to watch next. In that way, that's actually a very great way of marketing related shows, and it takes advantage of the internet's personalization. But I don't know if that marketing is keeping up with the behavior changing.
Is there any show that you've discovered via Hulu like that? They recommended a show to you that you hadn't watched or hadn't bothered to watch yet, and that sort of
lately
urged
they've been
you to
pushing
do?
The show Misfits on me when I see the commercial breaks, and so I have that bookmark to try out this week.
Well, you mentioned behavior changing faster than reality or faster than the physical world. And just stay with me here for a second because I think you'll see where I'm going with this. Because you are so prolific on Twitter, on Saturday night, when I looked at my BlackBerry and saw Whitney Houston dead at 48, which was coming from the Hollywood Reporter, I immediately went to my computer. And where did I go? I didn't go to the television and turn on CNN. I went to Twitter and went to trending topics and did a search for Whitney Houston. And sure enough, it seemed to be, you know, all over the place at that point. It seems more and more people are doing that. And on that evening, you were one of the big tweeters, if you will, because you were talking to Richard Rushfield and other journalists about the way CNN and other broadcast networks were covering the event.
That's right. That's right.
And what were they doing? They were going to read Twitter.
And I was saying to Richard, there's nothing wrong with reading Twitter. Reading Twitter on television is I would argue, interesting, new, different, maybe even valuable act by an anchor. But it's not journalism in the definition that we know it to be. So it requires maybe different talent. It requires maybe different production values. And I think we'll see some creativity along those lines in the coming years. You know, the Huffington Post is trying to create a live video network. They say they're going to do 12 hours a day. It's not going to be CNN, but it's going to play heavily on social media. It's going to be reading tweets all the time, reading Facebook comments all the time. And there is some value to doing that. It's just not what we traditionally think of as television.
Well, I think you need an editor. You need someone to not just stand there on the air and read whatever Twitter pops up next, but they need to look at a bunch of them and pull out the ones that are useful.
That's right. It's a needle in a haystack problem.
Well, do you think this, the fact that we now have data that young people are watching less TV, is this a small blip or is it going to be a trend downwards?
If I you know, I'm pausing because I hesitate to say for sure, but we have at least three quarters of proof that it's trending downwards. It appears to be trending downwards again in the fourth quarter of 2011 and so far in the first quarter of 2012. A lot of people in the industry have been wondering when viewership would peak on traditional television. And it makes sense that now is the time. It may turn out not to be, but it would make sense that now is the time where we start to see a decline. And of course, we're coming down from a very, very, very high mark. The amount of television viewing in this country is extraordinary.
What's
five
it like?
Hours
it's
a day. So
how many hours a day?
You know, 4 hours and maybe 30 minutes on average. But of course, older people watch more, sometimes 7-8 hours a day.
Oh,
so
wow. Okay.
This medium is going to be the primary medium for Americans for decades to come, most likely. But that said, it may begin to drift downwards in certain demographics, even if older demographics are watching more than ever.
Well, certainly, Brian, thank you for joining us. Your work can be found on the New York Times and also on Twitter. I know that the Twitter is not sure how you're making your bread and butter there, but the work you do really in conjunction with you know, your work on the New York Times, it seems like you're doing research almost on Twitter, and you're having an ongoing conversation during the day on Twitter, and then you go write a couple stories for the paper. I mean, it's phenomenal. Thank you very much
for
taking.
That's what I'm going to go do right now. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Talk to you
soon. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Well, Brian referenced a British TV series called Misfits, which is sort of a science fiction drama. It's sort of a TV version of Chronicle, the new movie that's in theaters. It's about a bunch of kids who get strange supernatural powers after an electrical storm. And I've heard about it for a few years. It debuted in 2009. It's only available in America via Hulu. And I have friends who've watched it, and it's fun to know that he's thinking about watching it too. I've got it on my wish list as well. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. But it's one of those shows that would have taken years, if ever, to come to the U.S., but because of the internet, it can be made available very quickly and easily, and it might be something that could gather steam, and then who knows what'll happen to it.
And I guess that's exactly what Brian Stelter was referring to by saying that the flattening out of media is occurring.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of media and social media, why don't you tweet to your friends or post on Facebook to your friends about Showbiz Sandbox? You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Our username is ShowbizSandbox, and you can email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to subscribe to us. You can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, on the Zune Marketplace, on Stitcher, in your favorite RSS reader or podcatcher. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Some of the work of Michael Giltz can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com. That's correct, right, Michael?
That's correct.
And some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.